everybody. So the last speaker is me. let me hit the timer since I was timing everybody else. I'll just say a couple of words to open. I'm a public health nutritionist by training. I've been in the working now 25 years, and my first 10 years was spent working for food banks, first in New York City and then in Alameda County, California. So a lot of my focus and growth as a professional was to realize that the tools I had been given when I studied public health 25 years ago, which were really about helping individual families access food and doing nutrition counseling, were not really going to be sufficient to change health across a community. And I came to Prevention Institute very interested and excited about the opportunity to work on public policy and to work on organizational practice change as key levers for influencing what is in our community and what messages and what access people had about food. And I spent almost 10 years co-founding and then directing the Strategic Alliance for Healthy Food and Activity Environments, which was a coalition started in California in 2001 that set out to reframe the discussion about obesity and diabetes, which was just starting up at that time, to really focus on not just individuals, but really on that community environment. And I am proud to say, as a City of Berkeley resident, that as one evolution of that work, we just passed a soda tax with 73% of voters approving. So we really, this reframe, which I really have seen change in the world of public health, especially around chronic disease, where I've been working, to focus on policy systems and environmental change is really having an impact. And I agree there's places, especially in rural areas, where we still need to do a better job of understanding the strategies. But I think we actually have had a lot of success. And kind of building on Prevention Institute's success as a community prevention organization, and that's what we do, we really focus on the practice of quality community prevention. We were asked by a community clinics initiative in California that really wanted to help community health centers prepare for the Affordable Care Act implementation. We were asked, well, how do you think community health centers could be more engaged in upstream prevention? So what I'm going to present now is a little bit of our thinking about the answer to that question, and we developed through that research a model called community-centered health homes. I'll tell you a little more about that. And then later in the presentation, I will share an update on some communities, North Carolina especially, that are in the middle of starting to roll out a community-centered health homes initiative. So, and I will do that all in the time frame allotted, I promise. I already mentioned the Affordable Care Act. President Obama talked about prevention and population health when he signed that bill, and that was very exciting to us because we feel that really opens the door. The triple aim, right? Improve population health, the experience of care, and reduce per capita costs. That's now official CMS. That's what they're asking healthcare institutions to do, and that is our opening to really think about the spectrum of prevention. Because we know population health is not about treating individuals one at a time. That's important. That must happen. There must be access to care. But if we're really going to change patterns of illness and injury across the community, we must make change along the spectrum of prevention. And that goes from strengthening individual knowledge and skills up to influencing policy and legislation. So while I was very excited to work on this paper and try to answer this question, I had to acknowledge these two gentlemen, Dr. Jack Geiger, Dr. John Hatch, who went to Mississippi from Tufts in Boston to open the first federally qualified health center in the country. Actually, there was one opened in Boston at the same time. This is the Delta Health Center, opened in Mound Bayou, Mississippi. They really are the pioneers in healthcare being engaged in upstream prevention. And actually, when I was a public health student, I took a course on community-oriented primary care, which became the description for what they were doing, and it was pretty simple. They saw extreme poverty. They saw a community that was destitute because there were no more jobs, because the cotton-picking industry had been mechanized, so there were no more jobs for folks. And the first, one of the things they did is they prescribed prescriptions for food. So we hear about green prescriptions today. It's not new. They did it back then, and they did it by asking local grocers, and Mount Bio is an African-American community. They asked the local grocers to provide food for the pharmacy, and then they gave people prescriptions, and there it was. And of course, you know, they were getting money from the federal government, and they were asked some questions like, excuse me, you're giving out food? What does that have to do with medicine? And what Jack Iger says he said is, excuse me, last time we looked in the book, the specific therapy for malnutrition was food. Now, they did not rest there, though. John Hatch's role was to start community health councils in 10 communities, and people were organizing to do things like put screen doors on their houses. They were getting infections because of the flies coming in. They got shoes for kids. They were building sanitation systems. And they also had one other kind of medical equipment they were interested in, and I heard Jack Iger say, well, you know, I put this in the budget for my health center, a tractor. Yes, he did. He put it in his budget. He said, I kind of buried it under women's health services. That, unfortunately, got kicked out of the budget. However, because there was such strong community participation, and really what seems to me, of course, coming many years later, as a very seamless relationship between community residents and the community health center in this very rural area, they actually started a cooperative farm. So they started not just providing prescriptions for food, but really creating a farm that was providing jobs and providing food access across the community. Medical homes have gotten, you know, the concept that everyone should have a medical home has been an important progress in thinking about healthcare. We've had a focus on patient-centered medical homes and the requirement that there is good coordination between primary care and specialists. I hate to say it, but when I grew up as a kid, that just happened naturally. But now we've had to legislate it, so there we go. But I think that's a good thing. We want our clinicians to talk to each other. Well, we would propose that we can also have a community-centered health home that really makes those links that especially Susan was talking about of getting engaged as a healthcare service agency in helping to change community environments to address upstream determinants of health. So our paper is available on our website, and we came up with the notion, actually, since I was trained in community-oriented primary care, it was kind of an easy thing to come up with the name community-centered health homes. It just came right out of that history. And we interviewed community health centers around the country that we heard, we just through the grapevine, we asked around, that were doing innovative work. Hidalgo Medical Services is one, and I'll tell you about another one. This is how we define a community-centered health home. It not only acknowledges that factors outside the healthcare system affect patient health outcomes, but also actively participates in improving those factors. I was trained as a public health nutritionist to do the former. Now it's exciting to be involved in thinking about how we do the latter, which is what we really need to do. When we came up with a framework for community-centered health homes, we thought, well, you know, clinicians are already thinking about patient intake and then, you know, getting information and then doing diagnosis and treatment. We think that's transferable to community prevention. So our community-centered health homes model has three phases: inquiry, analysis, and action. And I'm going to give you just an example of what I mean by that. If you want to see the detail, you can look on our website. So I'm going to tell you a story from St. John's Well Child and Family Center, which is based in California. And they had some presenting health conditions: lead poisoning, skin rashes, headaches, insect and rodent bites. What's the common factor? Can you go upstream? What's common? I hear environments. Anything? What's specific about the environment? Yes, you win the prize. Yeah, but this is a good example, right? This is what we need to do. We start with those presenting conditions, and then we say, what is the exposure or behavior that's causing the health problem? And, you know, it was lead, and it was skin, it was insects. But then if you take it the step upstream to environments, it's housing. So they, thankfully, not only noticed it was about housing, but they decided to form a community partnership to take action around housing. One element I'll share with you, in order to build the case, because they knew they were going to have to be engaged in advocacy, they did create a housing questionnaire that is now part of all well child visits and adult physical exams. So they're asking questions about mold, mildew, dripping, you know, whether there's areas of wetness that could cause a problem, and they're asking about infestation of rodents. This is their coalition, a pretty fabulous and hard-hitting group. And notice, I'm just checking my time here, notice that they had to partner to get the groups like the Strategic Actions for a Just Economy and the Los Angeles Community Action Network. These were really the advocates that came to partner with them. And then Esperanza Community Housing Corporation actually has community health workers that are engaged in helping to do some of this housing work. And what did they achieve? Well, they got policies. They really worked with legal aid and with the housing authority to get landlord compliance. Because one thing about this, when people talk about, oh, prevention, it costs too much money, this is cost-free prevention, because these landlords are breaking the law. They are breaking the law. They are required, if they are renting units, to have decent habitation. So we're not talking about money to build housing. We're talking about getting enforcement. And yes, there's some staff time involved in that, but that is actually relatively cheap to the investment you're getting for landlords to bring their housing up to code. So that's it gives you a sense of our inquiry, analysis, and action framework. And they had some documented success. And look at this first one. 4 out of 5 residents with anxiety related specifically to substandard housing reported health improvements. And they also saw specific improvements in health outcomes among 93% of their clients. And this is an ongoing effort, and it's one that continues to this day. So let me tell you that we developed this framework. Community Center Health Homes put the paper out there and have been really excited to see, and I think it's because of that focus on population health and the Affordable Care Act, a lot of interest in folks wanting to really take our model and implement it. And the two places that are going to be implementing it most immediately are North Carolina, funded by the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation of North Carolina, and right here, we're partnering with Louisiana Public Health Institute. They have invited us in to help with their rolling out of a community-centered health home demonstration project that will fund. They have a project called the Gulf Coast Primary Care Capacity Project that was funded through British Petroleum as a part of a settlement for what has happened along the Gulf Coast. And they're going to be funding a community health center. They just put out a funding opportunity announcement just to the 17 operators in their primary care network to implement community-centered health homes. They'll be funding one in Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and probably in New Orleans as well. So I'm excited. Usually I'm not the person up here talking about research, so I really wanted you to know it's going to happen on the ground. Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina as a foundation has a little more luxury of taking their time in putting an initiative in place. So the first thing they did was they actually asked us to do a landscape analysis of readiness among their community health centers and their healthcare community in North Carolina for this, for adopting community-centered health homes practices. So I'm going to share with you the results from that analysis and let you know a little bit about how they're rolling out the initiative. So first, we did a fairly small number of key informant interviews, but the foundation very carefully selected who we should talk to. These were the people they wanted to get on board. We asked about priority health concerns. Not surprising, really echoes what we've already seen here as in terms of concerns. And there was some specific discussion, and people did raise issues of social determinants of health. And I love this quote, came from a physician. Social determinants of health are driving poor health more than access ever did. Education, jobs, unemployment, transportation. These are the things that are driving poor health. And this is a big deal to me. I know a number of you are working in healthcare clinics, but I think it's a big deal that clinicians recognize that it's what's happening outside the clinic walls that's impacting health outcomes, and that's the stepping stone to then taking action to make change. Another quote, I used to think, well, why don't people take better care of themselves? This is also a physician. But then it dawned on me, half of what I'm holding them to is stuff they can't afford to do. Living in that high-stress environment, especially for children under 5, is a prescription for serious behavioral problems, physical illness, and school performance problems. And there's good data for that. You cannot significantly improve health status by just providing health care. So obviously the foundation encouraged us to talk to the folks who they thought they could get on board, but I still thought this was great to see these kind of comments coming from folks in the healthcare system. Now, their understanding of what I call community prevention, policy systems, and environmental change varied. So some folks thought it meant health education, some thought it meant intensive case management, some thought it was about services, you know, getting people to services, and then others did understand that there was also, building on all of these, a notion of community change. People, what they were actually doing at this point in terms of change primarily was health education, community-based health education, and then also some referral to services like housing. This was sort of a more innovative health care organization. And mind you, there's lots of innovative work going on upstream in North Carolina by other kinds of organizations, farming organizations, public health departments. But healthcare, by and large, has not been as engaged, but this particular healthcare agency was involved in helping support a community-supported agriculture. We asked them about what they thought healthcare role in prevention was, and I'll just share a few of the quotes. Generally thought people that come in and work here are concerned about wellness and of the community. Here comes a next thought. With the right sort of investment, healthcare can be a catalyst for improvements in schools, the built environment, and in fact, the community health needs assessment process and the community health improvement process highlights community issues and bridges those care needs with prevention and wellness. So generally what we saw was support. In terms of challenges with taking on these kind of practices, health reform, driving everybody crazy, the costs, you know, this feeling like the safety net. They have a lot of uninsured care. Their state did not adopt Medicaid expansion, and they're going to continue to have a lot of uninsured. So that was really concerning them. Big concern about mental health services. There's been a lot of cutbacks, so people talked about that. And then, of course, uncertainty. Everybody's nervous. What's happening next? But I think we've made it bold because this is the main thing. We just can't, in the current payment structure, do this work. So we asked them, okay, if you had payment, what would you do with it? A staff, and relatively few, right? 2 to 3 people who could really be that bridge to community. They would really like to have the payment incentives and align better so that the reward really is for good health, not for treatment. And finally, they really said that the workforce needs to be prepared. And I'm going to just skip along. It's interesting. We sort of have been drawing up capacities for implementation. It's very similar to Sue's list, so I'm not even going to talk about it. But I think, you know, I'm happy to share that. So where are things going in North Carolina? They are... What the foundation decided to do, oh, and one very cool thing about the foundation is they had a staff member focused on safety net programs, and they had a staff member focused on healthy food and activity environments, and for the first time in the foundation's history, they are now, and they're a small foundation, they are working together. This project has really brought them into thinking together, and they think of it as like Jen's people and Katie's people working together, but it's fabulous because it means that they both have bought into the model, and the vice president and president of their foundation have all bought into the idea that they're going to test this. They just had in October informational meetings around the state announcing the Community-Centered Health Home Initiative. In December, they are having a workshop that partnerships have to apply to, and it has to be a health community health center and a community partner have to apply together to come to this workshop, and they're going to have an intensive 2 days around some of the skills that are needed to be a community-centered health home. Then they're going to be able to apply for mini-grants to do a project together, and that project is really what the primary outcome of that is to have a successful experience of collaborating. Because in most of these communities, the only collaboration between healthcare and community-based organizations is that they refer to each other. That's the only, that they're not sitting around a table, they're not planning together. There are exceptions, of course, but it's not usual practice. So then, and this is, again, what I said, there in April, the mini project is due, they need to complete that, and then some of them will be invited to apply for a planning grant for a year to develop community-centered health home capacity, and then after the planning grant, hopefully there will be funding for implementation, two to three years implementation. So I will end there and invite you to ask questions of all the panelists, and I'm just going to go ahead and switch to my information slide. So thank you so much.